Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're discussing relational money help with financial therapist Ed Combs.
Yeah, so this is a timely episode since it's Valentine's Day today. We are really excited to be talking with Ed Combs. He's an internationally recognized leader in financial therapy who has been cited by the Wall Street Journal, the AP, many others. And he has the credentials as well. He's earned his master's degree in business, counseling, and financial planning, and is a licensed marriage and family therapist. He's a certified financial planner and certified financial therapist. He leads couples through therapy from financial despair and frustration into financial intimacy and connection by helping them to figure out and understand what is really going on. And so we're going to discuss some of the concepts in his book as well. His book is The Healthy Love and Money Way. And in the book, he explains where our attitudes toward money stem from and what it is that we should do about it. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Ed Combs, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Joel and Matt, thanks so much for having me on today. I'm super excited to be talking with you guys.
Ed, we're glad to have you, man. And the first question we ask anybody who comes on the podcast is, well, you know, Matt and I, we like to drink craft beer, and it's something that we splurge on while we're saving and investing for the future. But what's that equivalent in your life? What do you splurge on in the here and now while you're trying to also be smart with your money?
Oh, well, yesterday would probably be a great example of this, and it's kind of passing on to my kid, but biking. So I'm a huge mountain biker, and
oh,
I love
yes.
it.
Yes.
And I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. I took my son skiing up in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and we stopped in a great beer town, Boone, North Carolina.
Nice.
And I saw the local bike shop, and I was like, I got to go in there. I just want to see what's in there, and what do they have to say about the biking scene here. And of course, my son like goes meandering back into the store, starts looking at the bikes, and he's like, Dad. I'm like, what? I knew where this was going. He's like, this BMX bike is awesome. Like, I really want it. And, you know, he's been on me for who knows how long now. And so we're kind of in that store, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, now my wife is going to feel one way about this. He's going to feel another way about this. How do I get through this? And, you know, so he ended up getting the bike. He had some birthday money, Christmas money, and gift card money that he was willing to all trade okay. in for the bike. So we worked it out and then had a lovely conversation with my wife when we got home, who was quite surprised to see a bike after a ski trip to the mountains.
She's like, what were y'all doing? I thought y'all went skiing.
Well, I feel like Ed fits right in here with you and me, Matt, because we're avid bikers ourselves. We talk about it maybe too much on the show. And our listeners are like, start talking about money again, guys.
But less mountain biking, though, and more just kind of the practical nature of it. Just the around. Money, yep. the cost savings that come with it, the just staying healthy.
Exercise, yep.
All of those things. But I'm glad to hear, though, that your son, it sounded like this wasn't just you dropping a bunch of money on a bike that may or may not have been on sale. I like that he showed up to the table as well. He had his own money. I like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's been talking about it for a while, and he's 11, just turned 11. And so he's at that age where financial socialization really starts to kick in at a whole nother level. He's got the math wherewithal to do the addition and subtraction, and, you know, different than his younger brothers that are 5 and 4 and just aren't there yet.
Well, Ed, before we dive into the book, we're having some of these bigger conversations about mental health in our country these days, just generally speaking. We're not sweeping things under the rug as much as we used to. And it seems like financial therapy, which is what you do, it seems like that's becoming more common as well. Can you tell us about financial therapy and how it has evolved over time?
Yeah. So financial therapy has probably been around in some shape or form for quite a long time. But more formally, the Financial Therapy Association started about 12 years ago. And it's really a group of both mental health professionals and financial planners working together and saying, how do we do this better? Mm-hmm. And so what we really look at is how do we bring the counseling psychology processes into working with people's money? And so one of my favorite areas to talk about is this area of attachment styles, which we'll be talking a little bit more about. So financial therapy is growing, the recognition is growing, and certainly has helped me out a lot, because the big thing is I was able to anticipate my wife's reaction for the bicycle as well as my son, but it was also having the skills to work through that and manage that conversation that was probably even more important.
Gotcha. So would you say that's the main difference? Because yeah, you have that CFP certification, but there's a different like tact. There's a different approach that a CFP is going to take when they're giving you advice versus going to see a financial therapist, right? And like, can you kind of like, you know, what is the difference in as like an individual as you go to pick one of these people to go see and talk to and spend time with? What's kind of the different route they're going to take as they're helping you?
Yeah, this is a broad paint brush stroke, but the big difference is CFPs are more often going to tell you what to do and how to do it with your money, right? So if you need an investment strategy or the retirement plan or how does this impact my taxes, they're going to collect the data and then they're going to say, okay, here's your best options. A financial therapist is more going to look at your thoughts, your feelings, your behaviors, relationship dynamics that are often preventing you from even being able to talk with a financial planner about mm-hmm. your investments, taxes, insurance, estate planning. So we're really looking at any old kind of emotional pain, problematic thoughts around money that may be stopping you from moving to that next step.
So you're taking it another layer deeper. It's not just the nuts and bolts on the surface, but yeah, kind of more the why, some of those deeper issues. In your book, you talk about the four attachment styles. They're kind of the core message of your book. Can you give us an overview of those different attachment styles?
Yeah, absolutely. So attachment styles are secure, anxious, avoidant, and disorganized. And these attachment styles are broad categories of the way that people experience bonding in their intimate relationships. And the bonding starts obviously in our childhood, and the research would say in some ways even while you're in your mother's womb. But this is a well-researched area of psychology over the last 7 decades. And what they've identified are these 4 broad patterns. And the securely attached individual generally feels positive about themselves and positive about other people. They generally are trusting in relationships and can work through both good times and challenging times with another person. A person with an anxious attachment style is more often going to have a negative view of themselves and a more positive view of others. They're often wanting to bond, trying very hard to bond with their intimate partner, but never really sure that it's working quite so well or that they've met their partner's approval. On the other side of the attachment continuum are the avoidant attachment patterns, and those are the people that really like to do relationships on their own, right? They're going to keep people a little bit more at an arm's length distance, especially when it comes to emotionally sensitive topics. More often than not, they have a more positive view of themselves and a more negative view of others. They're a little more dismissing, basically. They've learned through their caregiving experiences, I can't trust other people to meet my own needs, so I have to become self-reliant. And then disorganized is some combination of the anxious and avoidant patterns. And the big thing that I like to remind people is each of these styles or patterns was very adaptive for your particular caregiving environment. It's not I should feel bad because I have an anxious attachment style or an avoidant attachment style. It's like, you know, you didn't pick your attachment style. That was a product of the way that you were raised. As a maturing adult, you may need to do some healing work around your attachment patterns so that you can move more towards that secure attachment, because that's where the research really helps us see that those are the people that have the higher relationship satisfaction, more effective communication skills. Those are the things that we need in order to be successful financially.
Yeah. Well, you actually wrote in the book, you said that discovering your attachment style has, and I quote, completely changed the way I think about personal finance. And I found that to be fascinating, that like as you kind of dug in and did some of that deeper work, that it changed the way you thought about money and how you handle it. So can you explain how that discovery made such a dramatic shift in your life and in how you handle money?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think it has given me a more formal lens for understanding both myself and my wife and where she's coming from and where I'm coming from and why I'm going to relate the way that I'm going to relate. So if we go back to my son's bicycle purchase from yesterday even, right, a little bit of that was anxious attachment also showing up. I knew that I probably should have just given my wife a call and a heads up and said, hey, this is where we're at. This is what we're thinking through. That would have been a little more collaborative. Right. But I was a little anxious about how she would respond. And so I was like, I'm just going to push this on the side. Plus, he's using his own money, so not that big of a deal. Right. But that didn't feel great for her when we came home. And so that was a relational misattunement. And I set myself up in that one. The other side of that, though, is as I've been growing, and as my wife is growing, the conversation actually furthered. She was telling me about some of the things that are happening in her practice. She's a dentist. There was an income dip in January. We're not really sure what happened, but you know, it had her anxious about the finances, and we were able to sit down and talk, and just instead of me becoming overly concerned about what do I need to do to take care of her and make sure everything's going to be all right and that somehow she's not upset at me, I just listened and helped her think through what does this mean, and then got to more of the practical side of, well, what do we do from here?
It's almost as if, yeah, understanding the other person and making sure that they feel understood is almost more important than actually solving the problem.
Yeah.
I know oftentimes in these conversations with my wife, I immediately jump to the nuts and bolts, you know, solving the problem when maybe that's not necessarily what's needed in the moment. I think
it's
oftentimes
like the knee-jerk reaction sometimes, though, for us.
Oh, my gosh.
And I don't want to like generalize all men, but I don't know. At least for me.
It's my default. Yeah, yeah. For sure.
It's like, let me fix this for you. And she's like, that's not what I'm after here.
Yeah. And yeah. And she's even told me, she's just like, I just want you to say, I'm sorry, that sucks.
Yeah. That's
and
it.
I've taken that to heart, and I say that often now. It's a part of my toolkit. But Ed, something else that stuck out to me is when you wrote, your relationship with money is governed less by what you know about money and how it is that you experience yourself and others. You know, this is kind of going back to what we just talked about, you know, the difference between a financial therapist and a CFP. But the thing is, like, if that's the case, then is the solution to our money problems, is it less about learning to budget or you know, opening a Roth IRA? And is it more about doing some of this internal work ourselves?
Yeah, I think that's the position that I've landed in. And it's been a long journey to get to this point. But there's certainly a place for increasing your financial literacy and knowledge of how money works so that you can do it well or appropriately. But the challenge is that financial planning often ends up looking a lot like dieting, right? It's like people know what to do, but they don't do it. Or they do it for a little bit and then they change paths.
Mm-hmm.
And so that starts to beg the deeper question of what's going on inside of me? How am I responding or reacting to money? How is my sense of self impacting the way that I show up around money? So do I have a positive view of myself, which says I can be resilient through financial struggles and be comfortable with the fact of increasing success and change? Or do those things throw me off kilter?
Well, I don't want to discount the value that a financial therapist can bring, or the therapist in general can bring. My wife is actually in school getting her master's degree right now to become a marriage and family therapist, and I think there's like so much good
you.
There. I know, right? I'm kind of like the she's writing all her papers about my idiosyncrasies, which she's getting great grades.
I thought you were going to say a different word.
I've got a lot of issues that she can diagnose. But is there any way, Ed? I am curious. How would you suggest people start to kind of DIY and start to think through, do some of this internal work on their own? Like, obviously it's great to go see an expert in the field, but is there a way that people can kind of begin and start to do some of this dredging up, some of this internal work before they even go visit a professional?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I see, you know, Joel, you did your money origin story, it looks like, not too long ago. So reflection in psychology, and especially in counseling, is a huge part of our growth, right? So becoming a more reflective person is the process of integrating and making sense out of and sometimes recovering from those painful experiences in the past. But what you want to do is you can start taking a money history, your own money history. So you can look back and try to remember back to your earliest points in time and see what are those financial events that happened. And just start laying out kind of a timeline. So you can even get a piece of paper out and write a nice little timeline and put age zero into age wherever you are now and just start doing hash marks. And you can just make little notes. And what we're looking for in an activity like this is, did you have mostly positive associations and memories around money, mostly negative, some combination of the two? And at that very first glance through it, what we want to make sure is, can I see both the good and bad? Right? That's part of secure functioning from an attachment perspective, is we're not overly focused on the good, but we're not also overly focused on the bad. So if you have a money timeline that starts showing all kinds of painful experiences around money and that's all that's coming up for you, that's a good sign that you probably do need to go work with a financial therapist. Mm. But if you have, you know, a mix of different experiences around money, and when you look back on those more challenging or painful money experiences, if you can remain reflective and draw out the lessons learned, then it's probably not what I would call money trauma. But what happens is oftentimes we have money trauma where it's like, I don't even want to remember those bad things that happened financially, because if I do, I'll become overwhelmed with the emotions and the associations associated with it.
And that's where, if someone's feeling those feelings, that's where it's probably most helpful. Like if you do find you have the good and the bad and you have that more secure attachment, you can probably do some of this work on your own. But if you feel like you're shoving things down underneath the surface and you're like unwilling to deal with them, or if everything's coming up negative, that's when you probably would be, an expert would be helpful.
An expert would be really helpful, right? Because a lot of what we talk about is, it's not always even about remembering all the bad things that happened, but it's about helping you, your mind psychologically recognize that that experience is over and it's in the past. And it's not about forgetting it. It's about being able to make meaning and help really at the physiological level, which is the core of us, recognize it's safe now. That threat has passed.
Yes, it's not something that's currently hanging over your head where you feel like you have to be on high alert. Like maybe, yeah, there was a period, say, right out of college where you were incredibly low on funds and you were kind of living paycheck to paycheck. That threat of feeling like you're about to get evicted, you're saying essentially that that is something we can carry into our future that's affecting us now?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to say too, you're right. Like, and going back to, you mentioned my money origin story, that's one of those things where there was certainly a combo of good and bad things when it came to money and how I viewed money. And even those negative things, I feel like for a while, especially in my early mid-20s, like they kind of influenced how I did everything when it came to how I handled money. And now I've done some work and I've grown, and I feel like those things are memories and they're still impactful, but they don't hold the same weight or sway over me that they did like 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Joel, I think you're on the point there. Is what that work looks like can be varied for a lot of different people, but it is, you became curious at some level about how is my past shaping my present? What do I need to learn or grow into something different now? And that can help bring resolution to those painful things that happened in the past. And you know, the gift of talking with many, many money experts in a wide variety of fields, most of them have had some pretty defining painful experiences around money that sent them on the transformational journey. Or if your listeners are familiar with a hero's journey, that's another lens that I like to use in my work with clients, is that doing your money work is very much a hero's journey.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so doing that work yourself, that can be one way you arrive to that point. But I think a partner, somebody, a significant other, can also be the refiner's fire as you grow and seek to, you know, evolve in your relationship. So we're actually going to talk more about that. We're going to talk about couples and finance. We're going to get to all of that right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. We're still talking with financial therapist Ed Combs. And Ed, sometimes it's helpful to know that the struggles you're facing aren't unique. And I think sometimes we're like, nobody knows what I've gone through. Nobody else can identify. And you feel alone in what you've gone through. And that makes it even more difficult. And that maybe even makes the negative things you've experienced feel bigger than they actually were. So yeah, what are maybe some of the most common issues that you find yourself helping folks with at your practice, so that maybe How to Money listeners can realize, oh wait, that's not completely abnormal?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the biggest dynamics is around spending and saving. And you know, on the surface, it looks like we're having a fight about spending and saving, but oftentimes it's a fight over power and control and influence and mutual respect. And so when I meet with my couples around these issues, certainly I'm trying to understand their attachment styles, because that's their relationship blueprint about how they're going to experience relationships. I want to know about their money history, and I want to know what they've done in the past to try to resolve this, right? Because I want them to get more and more creative about being responsible for solving the problems. In the long run, they're going to live with each other and not be seeing me. And so I want them to be empowered around being able to find their own resolutions. My job is to help facilitate them in that direction. So common things are certainly some degree of poverty or financial scarcity in childhood is often a backdrop to the present day problems. I've had quite a handful of clients that grew up with affluent or wealthy parents that really mismanaged the finances. And so there, while there was this income and wealth, there's also high degrees of financial stress and anxiety. And so that mismatch often continues forward for a lot of clients. Hmm. Problems around financial transparency and being honest about how much money has been spent is another big issue that comes up.
And I think all of those issues probably sound familiar to a lot of folks in one way or another. There are these just different dynamics that we are faced with. And so, Ed, let's kind of dive into dating. Before there's marriage, we've got dating. And then, you know, first of all, how important is it to discuss finances with someone who you are building a relationship with? And specifically, you know, I want to know how soon should a couple actually have this conversation?
As soon as you have your first kiss, it's time to have the first money conversation.
Okay. All right. So right after that hot and heavy, sweet makeout session, you dive into your financial stuff.
So tell me about your balance sheet right after the hot and heavy makeout session.
There you go.
No, you can leave that for the second date. no, but what I would encourage people listening to think about is in that dating sequence, right? You're over time getting to know whether you like being in their company in general, whether there's a sense of emotional compatibility, whether there's a sense of sexual intimacy and compatibility on whatever that pacing or framework is for you. And so in the same sense, money becomes another natural point in that dating sequence where you want to start to get to know this person financially. And it's about what are their preferences? What are the things that they don't like? Can they be reflective on lessons learned on money? Are they able to talk about goals and ambitions? What's their family history around money like? Those are all really important starter points to gauging the other person's readiness to engage in a healthy and productive financial relationship with you. Because if your relationship is going to progress forward, your life will be intertwined financially. There's just no way around it.
How do you create that open place? Because, you don't want to just be like, all right, it's it now. Let me see your credit score. You probably do want to cover stuff like that, but how do you do it in a way that's going to like foster healthy communication and where it feels like a safe place where you can kind of talk about those things as opposed to feeling like you're just pestering someone to get their financial details out in the open?
Yeah. So I think the word safe place, right? So if you're in that newly dating or early stages relationship, it may feel a little awkward and tentative to lead into the conversation. And I think the other big framing is it's not a one-time conversation. This is an ongoing conversation where we're going to open up these questions. And sometimes it'll be casual. Maybe it's over a beer or a glass of wine. If you're moving further into that relationship, maybe it becomes more structured. We do sit down and look at each other's patterns of spending. What does that feel like to become more financially transparent with this other person? So it's, at some point you want to get financially naked with the person. No, it's not on the first date, probably not in the first month, but over time, if the relationship is maturing and headed in that direction where you see a longer term together, you really do want to work on that. And this is assuming you're in the position of being proactive. There might be some people listening thinking, holy crap, what is this guy talking about? I don't want to do that. That sounds terrifying to me. And if that's where you're at, completely understandable, no problem. But as we were talking about earlier, that maybe is a signal that it's time for you to start doing some of your own money work. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of great books. You guys mentioned my book. I really appreciate that. There's plenty of other great money books out there that look more at your personal relationship with money than at the numbers and spreadsheets and strategy side, as important as that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so specifically, Ed, I mean, you said getting financially naked. Like, what exactly does that look like? Like, let's get specific with details. Like, what kind of information should we be sharing? Because we joke about sharing a credit score, or we might joke about student loans or something like that. But like, I guess what is some practical advice for folks as to what they should consider sharing with their partner?
Right. So on the objective side, it's your budget or spending patterns, a net worth statement, and credit score. And this is not to judge them, but to just have a sense of starting mutuality, because you're not going to bring the same thing to the table financially. But this is part of this bigger picture that I'm really encouraging more and more couples towards, which is financial intimacy. Mm-hmm. Right? And when you have financial intimacy in the relationship, nothing is off limits, and you can talk about anything safely, openly, candidly with each other. So this is where that attachment framework really helps people understand. If you're struggling to think about doing this, we may need to look at your attachment history and your patterns of relationship bonding and safety and security and transparency.
So do you think maybe that's part of it then too? So we're you mentioned that credit score, sharing spending patterns, those are some of those objective things that we do need to share with the person that we're growing closer to. Do you think there's an important thing that we're like, those two people should also work towards knowing each other's attachment style so that they can understand each other in a deeper way? And is there a way that they can do that, kind of find that out about themselves, and so that they can then maybe have a more of a common language to be able to, and an understanding of kind of where their, you know, significant other's coming from?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have an attachment style quiz on my website, healthylovingmoney.com. You can also Google attachment style quizzes. There's several different resources out, plenty of resources out there to start to become familiar with it. And you're right, attachment styles can become a language or relationship framework for you to understand both who am I now and where do I want to go in the future. And that's been one of the most rewarding things as I talk to people that are taking the attachment style quiz, is like, oh, I can see how I used to be. And now after some time in therapy, I can see that I'm much more secure. Right. So it gives a framework for relational growth as well. And as you dive deeper into understanding your attachment styles, it just creates more and more clarity about why am I the way I am? Where are my triggers or sore spots around relationship connection? And then what do I need to do to start getting some healing and relief around that? And it often then the other partner can also recognize, oh, this isn't just about me not being responsive to them, or the way that I'm responsive, it's about their attachment history and the unmet emotional and relational needs that they had.
As you are explaining this, Ed, I mean, I realize I've had a lot of conversations with my wife about money, and I don't know if maybe it's just because we have similar attachment styles, we've been able to work forward, and I guess neither of us have really been all that frustrated with how the other handles money, and so I guess in that way we've gotten lucky, but because of that, this isn't something we've ever addressed head on. You know, we haven't gotten down and really picked apart some of these attachment styles and what that means to us.
Makes me wonder if there's a fifth attachment style of nerdy, because that's Matt's attachment towards money. Is that one, Ed? Did I just come up with a new one? Is this groundbreaking
secure
research stuff?
Secure in numbers. I don't know. Yeah. Excel, is that one? It's just called Excel.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So attachments is really about your interpersonal bonding, right? Like how you experience interpersonal relationships. And then the way you approach money can be different than your attachment style, psychologically speaking. But if you're anxious, then you're more likely to feel rejected or uncertain in the relationship about how to navigate these difficult money conversations with your partner. Whereas if you're more on that avoiding continuum, it's like, I'm not going to include you in what's going on here financially. Like, I can't really trust you to understand me. So why would I let you in?
Yeah, well, and Ed, you know, when we were talking about some of the specifics to share, you shared that there are some different objective, you know, pieces of data that we need to share, like your credit score, things like that. Is there a set of subjective details or I guess goals that we need to talk about with our partners?
Yeah, that's where we start getting into both the positive side of things and the challenging or dash negative side of things, is like your fears, your anxieties, maybe even places of shame around money. Like, maybe I know what I should be doing with money, but I'm not doing it. Or, you know, I spend money in this way or that way that I feel embarrassed about. Maybe I feel controlled by my parents and the way that they manage the money between me and them. Maybe I've felt financially responsible for other family members that I feel resentful for. So those are the challenging side of money dynamics in relationships. But then it's also about sharing your hopes, your dreams, your aspirations. And surprisingly, a lot of people really struggle in this area to actually adequately articulate hopes, dreams, values. And so that's an area to dig into as a couple and to start exploring and cultivating. And, you know, in a very simple way, I'm a big dreamer and my wife is much more practical. And so that's a dynamic that gets challenging, is it's no problem for me, like, oh, I'm dreaming about a lake house and a boat and I want to go on a vacation. And her head's like just registering dollar signals for all of this instead of just tracking with me and be like, wow, that's really interesting. Tell me more about why that's important to you. right? Because there is meaning for me around those. And this is that other side of mutuality, is being able to draw my wife into that place of hopes, dreams, and aspirations, but also in staying balanced with the practical and holding both ends of those things together. So that's those are much more the subjective elements of managing money life together.
Got it. Yeah, good stuff. All right, we've got some more questions to get to about how couples can handle money well together, and including we're going to talk about how to handle conflict, because that's kind of inevitable when you're in love with someone else and you've got to talk about money. So we'll get to some questions on that right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break, and we are speaking with a financial therapist, Ed Combs. Ed, how do you help couples who are on completely different pages when it comes to how it is that they handle money? If they're just not
yin and yang.
Seriously. I mean, in some ways, I feel like it can be helpful because it can help couples to balance out. But oftentimes, I think it can keep you from being able to progress forward at all. How would you help out in that situation?
Yeah, so absolutely true. Those are big dynamics to draw out. When I talk with couples, I normalize the reality that you're going to be similar and different around money. And it's more often where we're different around money that the conflict starts to show up. But this is where I like to take them a step deeper before we try to get together on the topic. We've been talking throughout this show about money histories. And a lot of times couples know bits and pieces of each other's money history, but they haven't really ever heard it in kind of a full story format. And maybe they haven't done it for themselves, right? So if you're fighting about these differences, the big starting point is getting curious about, where do these differences come from? Where in my history and life did this outlook on money come from? What does that mean or represent to me? Why am I doing it that way? And then why for the same for the other person? Because the reality is there are reasons and motivations for why we're doing what we're doing with money. They may not always be immediately conscious or aware, but if we go back into our money history and can start to dig into what different emotions got attached with different money experiences, we can usually start to ferret it out. So as a more practical example, I had a couple where the wife was would do a lot more of the shopping. She would get secretive about it. And the husband would be kind of controlling of her about her spending. And so they came to me to get help around this, because she would promise, I'm not going to spend anymore. And then 6 months to a year later, she would be back to shopping and spending. Hmm. And so that was a really frustrating cycle for the couple. And you know, I think some people would hear this and be like, oh, well, there's abuse in the relationship. Well, no, it wasn't really about abuse. It was about their own painful past experiences around money. And in very short form, trying to protect their confidentiality, she had lost her mother in childhood. Hmm. And one of those ways that her family kind of, if you will, took care of her as she aged is they would take her shopping to make her feel better, right? And so as she was now an adult married woman, anytime that she started to feel stressed, her brain associated stress, not feeling good, go shopping. Hmm. Well, this was in perfect contrast to her husband, who had grown up in an environment where he was very sensitive to his mother and the financial challenges that they were experiencing. And when he would recall going shopping, and his older brothers would not think twice about getting a bunch of clothes at the department store. Meanwhile, he's watching his mom's face kind of like drop in sorrow and overwhelm. Hmm. And he would restrict what he would buy to try to lessen the blow to mom.
So it's where, yeah, doing that deeper work, it helps you realize, oh, wait, the love of my life is not doing this to sabotage me or to ruin our financial goals or plans. It comes from this deeper place, and you can like sympathize and empathize more with your significant other then, right?
That's exactly right. And that's the exact goal of that type of exercise, is for most couples, that's where they land in that type of exercise. If they're not able to step into that empathy and sympathy for each other's past stories, that just means that there's often even more emotional pain and hurt for them that they need to be able to work through before they can really see each other's side of the story and how that's shaped them.
Yeah. Yeah, there were some recent stats that came out about financial infidelity, Ed, that I think creditcards.com did a survey, and it certainly seems like it's on the rise, where couples are hiding spending from one another, or they have maybe a credit card that they haven't revealed to their partner. And you actually detail in the book about some financial infidelity that happened inside of your marriage, and it's a very personal story. But since you shared it in your book, would you mind sharing it with us here?
Yeah, absolutely. So financial infidelity is a breach in relational trust, both implicit and explicit expectations around money, right? And so for me, my wife had launched her dental practice. This has been a much larger part of our ongoing marital dynamic. And part of why I got here is at a values level, I would say I have no problem with women making more money than men. But at a lived experience, it's played on some of my own insecurities. Mm. And so I went back to school to become a therapist. I left the working world, wasn't making any money, had been a stay-at-home dad, and was trying to get back into getting my counseling practice up and going. And by this time, I thought, I'll figure it out. I helped my wife grow her dental practice, and how hard can it be to grow a counseling practice? And let me just say, it was nothing like growing a dental practice.
Okay.
And
harder.
Much harder, because, we would go to parties and people would find out my wife is a dentist, and they would say, "Oh, can I have your card?" And I would say I'm a therapist, and they would kind of walk away from me.
Well, it's like, so everybody knows,
like,
they need a teeth cleaning, but most people think that they're pretty good internally. they think that, even though that's probably not necessarily true.
Well, and therapists, we don't work with people that we know, like that we don't have we have regular engagement with. So that was those dynamics. There was so many different layers to this cake, so to speak. But from a financial infidelity standpoint, is I, had made my projections about how quickly the practice would get going, use some money, credit card money, to get things going, and got stuck in this rationalization, like, well, she makes plenty of money. If this doesn't work out, she'll be able to cover it. And so I just didn't tell her about how bad things were getting. And I had some other mental health things that were really starting to spiral out of control for me, falling into a pretty significant major depression. And so it's this complex constellation of experiences that led me to not be transparent with my wife about where we're at financially. Eventually it did break through, and we had to work through that and make meaning, make sense out of how did we get here. Fortunately, we had quite a number of years of financial transparency and trust prior to that. And so she could see kind of contextually how I got there. It didn't mean that it doesn't sting or didn't sting at that time. And, we work very hard now to maintain financial transparency. And this is a really challenging place for a lot of couples where one or both people are in business, because income variability is a part of the journey. And so you're trying to make projections and some level of commitment to this is what I can bring into the family. But then reality hits and it's not always pretty.
What if someone is actually in an unhealthy or even an abusive relationship? Money can oftentimes, I think, it can be used as a tool. It can maybe even be used as a weapon. And so what are maybe some signs that this is going on in a relationship? And then what should someone do about it if they realize that they are in an abusive or toxic relationship?
Yeah, so straight away, get to a couples therapist as fast as you can. Even if you have that sense or you're questioning it, do your Google research if you need to, but it's better just go ahead and get into a couples therapist, because it's like, it's better to have the chest pain and go to the doctor and have the doctor say, "Oh, this is something, mild, not a big deal," or, "No, you're about to have a heart attack."
Mm-hmm.
Right? You want to get in front of professional eyes that work with abusive relationships regularly so that they can help you differentiate, because it's very hard people when they're in the abusive relationship to come to terms and work through that. And so my encouragement, even if you think that you're in an abusive relationship, just go ahead and get into couples therapy, or go find a therapist and start asking your questions and sharing your story. You're so mired in it that you're not going to be able to see it clearly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And if someone has been listening, Ed, and they're like, "Yeah, okay, it sounds like I need to see a financial therapist," or where should they go? Is there a resource where you would tell people to turn to find someone close to them that can help them out in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're thinking my issue is more kind of around how I interact with money, the Financial Therapy Association is a wonderful starting place. They have a find a therapist tool there. So that's for the financial therapy side of things. And then for couples therapists, Psychology Today has a great therapist directory and listing there, and you can search by all kinds of different criteria for therapists in your local area.
And I wanted to say, Ed, like, I know some people might say, that's an odd choice of an episode to do on Valentine's Day, to talk about all these things. But I think, like, I think sometimes maybe we misunderstand what love is in our culture. And I think truly loving somebody else is, and truly loving yourself is doing some of these, this hard work and growing together over time in ways that aren't necessarily easy. And so, yeah, Matt and I, we really appreciate you coming on and talking about some of the harder things that we have to deal with, particularly like getting on the same page about money and doing some of that. Yeah. Those deeper dives into kind of our money history. So, yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show. And where can our listeners find out more about you and what you're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. My website, healthyloveandmoney.com, is probably the best place to get started. From there, have blogs, social media links, my book that you guys mentioned. I'm very excited about a new course that I'm launching, The Couple's Guide to Financial Intimacy.
Nice.
And so if you're thinking you want to do the deep dive, that's going to be a year-long program that you can check out and see if that's a good fit for you.
That's awesome. We'll make sure to link to all of that and specifically to the links where folks can learn more about that course. Ed, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Joel and Matt, it's been quite a pleasure talking with you. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to being a guest in the future.
Yeah, Joel, hopefully we will be able to have Ed back on because these topics are so important for us to talk about, and I'm glad that we were able to dive into them today.
Yeah.
Specifically, what was your big takeaway from this episode?
All right, that's a good question.
From this conversation.
I think the biggest takeaway I had was that, one, the common issues he mentioned are ones that plague all of us. Even people that are good with money still have money arguments or still have money disagreements. And I think what he pointed at was the fact that there is almost always something deeper going on there, or maybe even always, right? Mm-hmm. Where it is more about like power or dynamics or you want respect from your partner or, there's a lack of transparency going on that you feel uncomfortable with. And so I think, mm-hmm. when you are having, money fights or disagreements, it's important to kind of like go another level deeper in order to kind of assess, well, why is it that I'm reacting this way? Or why is it that I'm so upset right now because my partner spent money in that way, which I would never spend money in that way. And I know that over the years, like I've had to come to grips with some of those things in my own life where it's like, oh, that's my insecurity coming out. That's not Emily's fault. That's my fault. Mm-hmm. So yeah, digging that next layer deeper into what's happening beneath the surface is so crucial to actually being able to talk about money in a more productive way with the person that you love, with your significant other.
That's so true. And, you kind of talked about transparency and how there might need to be more of that when mm-hmm. it comes to some of the disagreements we have. I loved how when he talked about what he called financial infidelity on his part, it doesn't have to be this giant, massive thing. It can just literally be a lack of transparency where you're not sharing information. I think sometimes when you say financial infidelity, it sounds like this massive, big, breach of trust. When in reality, it can start, and it is, but it likely started very innocently, mm-hmm. Like at a very small scale where maybe you weren't quite as transparent with your spending. And so that's a little piggyback onto yours. But my big takeaway, I wanted to focus on how he talked about digging into your own history with money. And he explained how what you could do is just, draw a line, put some hash marks on there and create a timeline. And for a culture who probably doesn't reflect as much as we need to, that to me was just a great tool, a great way to think back on your history to see if you can isolate, see if you can find and identify some of the different events that occurred in your past mm-hmm. that might be worth sharing with your partner, right? As you start to build up that relationship, as you start having some more of these important conversations, you might be able to identify some of these things that you might want to share with them, and that mm-hmm. might allow them to get a feel for who you are, why it is that you do spend the way you do, or why it is that you don't spend money at all.
And help you come to grips with that yourself. You might recall milestones or markers in your life that you'd forgotten about.
You're like, oh, wow, that really had a pretty big impact on me. Yeah, it's about that self-discovery, but then being able to then take that, hopefully, whole self to a relationship.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you combine two different people who have not, you know, reflected and who haven't really dealt with their past, then it's kind of a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Right? You take two broken people, bring them together, as opposed to two folks who have an awareness of what they've been through and what they're looking to grow together. I think that's really important.
Yeah, for sure. I like that. All right. Well, that was a fun conversation, and hopefully more conversations like that in the future on how to money.
And hopefully it was, I mean, ultimately, I like what you said there at the end too. It seems like a kind of a weird topic.
Yeah. It's like, it's supposed to be the lovey-dovey day.
Yeah. And ultimately it is. But man, love, it's hard work. It's not just like, okay, how can you afford to buy chocolate for your partner that's cheap? Like, we want to take
this. You might
not
want to get him the cheap chocolate, because that doesn't say I love you.
Get the good stuff from Aldi, the German chocolate, like Leon Brown told us about. But we wanted to take it a level deeper to really get at the root of what makes relationships and love successful. And so that is why we wanted to have this conversation today, even though at times it kind of got a little more heavy, a little more serious.
Yeah. All right. Well, I agree. And for you and I, what makes our relationship successful is drinking good beer together and talking about money. And so on today's episode, while we talked with Ed, we were drinking a Grimm Lilt. Grimm is this brewery out of Brooklyn, New York, I believe. They make some awesome beers. And this is a golden sour, aged in oak barrels with tart cherries. Matt, what were your thoughts on this beer?
Dude, this is a fantastic beer. When it comes to sours, fruited sours that are barrel aged, this has everything that I'm looking for. It's got that tartness. It's got the acidity, so it feels bright and crisp in your mouth. It's got the right amount of fruit. But then it's got that funkiness.
Yeah.
Some of those woody notes, some of those oak flavors.
A lot of oak going on for sure.
Oh, it is so good. It checks all the boxes for what I'm looking for in a sour. You know, one of the things we talk about when we're talking about barrel-aged sours is how those barrels add a level of complexity to the flavor compared to a kettle sour, which, in my opinion, oftentimes can taste a little, not flat, but just kind of like one note. And I love that with a barrel-aged sour, oftentimes you get that true depth. And that's definitely what we've got going on here. But what were your thoughts?
No, I think you're right.
Did you dig the cherries?
It's like a single note versus a chord, right? And,
yes.
And, and so this beer was like a beautifully played chord. I dug the cherries. I love cherries in a beer. But then also, just that strong oak presence combined with the like very tartness, a little bit of funkiness, and Grimm makes some really good beers. Sadly, we've never been to the brewery. Hopefully one of these days.
Yep.
But this beer makes me want to go even more because it was delicious.
What if we started taking brewery trips? Like, we talk about going to visit certain breweries in certain cities, and some cities have a lot of good breweries.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something you and I can prioritize in the coming years.
Had a money road trip. Let's do it. All right. Well, happy Valentine's Day to everyone out there. I hope you got some motivation to attend to your relationship even more in this coming year after listening to this episode. We wish you the best of luck. And that's going to do it for this episode, Matt. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.